Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We've reported before on white nose syndrome, the fungal disease with the potential to wipe out vast numbers of bats in the United States. Not long ago, though, the first potentially positive piece of news came out on that front. Researchers for the first time released bats back into the wild after successfully treating them for white nose syndrome.
The U.S. Forest Service is keenly interested in the health of the nation's bat population. Cynthia Sandino is regional program leader for threatened, endangered, and sensitive species within the eastern region of the Forest Service, which is based in Milwaukee. And she's with us in the studio to talk all things bat. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Why do bats matter in the grand scheme of things?
How long do we have to talk about that question today?
As long as it takes.
Okay. Oh, gosh. Bats are important for so many reasons. So, you know, as a biologist, for me, just because they're so fascinating, there's over 1,300 species of bats. They range from bats that eat insects all the way up to bats that eat fish and frogs. So, I mean, there's just an incredible amount of diversity in bats. But maybe from more of an economic, environmental aspect, they're
also
very important.
Sure, I don't know that people have considered the economic impact of bats.
Oh, there's a huge economic value. So there have been some studies that have gone out here recently to try to quantify what the value of bats is. And we found that they provide between $3 billion and $23 billion, with a B, dollars worth of insect control to farmers. And so actually, Bat Conservation International just did a study, and they found that worldwide, bats provide over $1 billion of pest services for the corn industry alone. So if you like corn, if you like ethanol, if you like candy made out of corn syrup or soft drinks, you should care about bats. But they also do other important things in the tropics. They actually are important pollinators. So they pollinate over 500 species of plants, including some really important ones to us like bananas, mangoes, and also a little known fact maybe by a lot of folks. We have three species of bats in the United States that are pollinators, one of which is the lesser long-nosed bat. And it pollinates a little plant called the agave plant, which is where tequila comes from. And they are the primary pollinator of that plant. So if you like tequila, you should care about bats.
Now, this is surprising at a number of levels. One that I think all of us went to school and thought that really only birds and insects were animals that did pollination.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, a lot of folks are familiar with birds and they're familiar with bees, which are extremely important pollinators. But our bats are also very important. And they're important because they're active at night. And so all of those plants that are flowering at night, they need a little bit special services, which our bats can provide.
Well, so talk about the condition that the bat population is in. We've all probably at least heard of white nose syndrome. What's the state of the bat population at this stage of the game?
You know, so it's great that I'm here today versus maybe a couple of years ago when it was all really gloom and doom, because there are some glimmers of hope. But it is still a very tenuous situation. So we know that over 6 million bats have died in just 6 years from white nose syndrome. And so basically this disease is coming and killing our bats when they're hibernating in caves and mines. And so, you know, the first several years that this fungus, this disease has been around, has really been about trying to figure out what it is. And so we've learned a lot about it.
Right. What more do we know about it today than we did when it first came onto the scene?
Well, we know a little bit more about, you know, well, we've actually categorized the fungus that causes the disease. So, that, you know, that's been a new find, because this is a brand new fungus to science. We didn't know anything about it. So we know a little bit more about the family and the genus that the fungus falls into. And then we also know a little bit more about how it works. So it actually goes into the skin tissue of the bats. It invades the cells. And it disrupts all kinds of processes. Basically, what happens, just very basically, is that the bats are waking up more often from hibernation than they should, and they don't have enough energy to make it through the winter. So this disease is basically causing them to wake up and essentially starve to death. We know a lot more about how it's spread. We know that it's spread from bat to bat. We know that a bat can spread it to a cave, and then a new uninfected bat can come into a cave and actually get it from the cave. And there is some evidence that it can be transmitted from humans. So if a human goes into one cave, maybe doesn't clean their gear properly, goes into another cave, they could actually transport the disease as well. Here in the last year, and this is where we get into that glimmer of hope, we're starting to find some potential treatments. This fungus is so complex that we'll never have one cure. And I think that's really important for folks to know. And a lot of the articles that have gone out recently are calling things a cure. We don't have a cure. We have some treatments. Most of those treatments have only been I guess, tested in a lab. So we haven't gone to field testing yet, and that's something we're going to be doing in the coming years. And so, you know, 3 years ago, the idea of actually having a field test for a potential treatment for white nose syndrome was unheard of. So that's pretty exciting, if you ask me.
Well, and I gather that things have gone well enough in the lab in the sense that there have been some bats that have been successfully treated and been able to be released back into the wild. Is that right?
That is right. And so, I mean, there are a lot of researchers, both in academia, in state government and federal government, that are working on this. And I'm very proud to say that the Forest Service is one of the leading research agencies that's working on a treatment for white nose syndrome. And so actually this past May, there was a research project that was conducted where they took about 150 bats that were infected with white nose syndrome. They tried an experimental treatment on those bats, and they released about 50% of those bats, and they did not show signs of white nose syndrome any longer. So again, lots of really good evidence that we're on our way to finding a successful treatment, but we're not quite there yet.
Well, and when you're talking about a situation that's impacting millions of bats and millions of or many, many habitats, the issue must be scalability to a large degree.
Yeah. So, you know, fungal infections of any kind are notoriously hard to treat. So if you're talking about treating a fungus in a mammal, how do you do that on a large scale? But the really complex part of this is that where bats are being affected are when they're hibernating in caves. And so you have these wonderfully dark, wet conditions that are just perfect for this fungus to grow. And then you have a cave ecosystem that is based almost entirely on fungus and bacteria. So even if you had some sort of a spray that you could go in and just spray down the whole cave, who knows what else you could kill. And so that's really where this field treatment part comes into play. We have to figure out a treatment that's going to be effective on this fungus, but not cause other problems as well. And so then how do you do that in a large-scale cave? And I don't know that we're there yet.
Well, so white nose syndrome gets the bat headlines, if you will. But are there other issues that are facing bats that also make their situation tenuous?
Yeah. Right now, white nose syndrome is definitely the biggest threat to our bats here in North America. But there are some other big issues out there that they're definitely facing. One of them is wind development, which is a wonderful green alternative to energy, but it definitely has some cost associated with it. And so we are learning more and more about bats and how these wind turbines actually can kill bats. And the estimates are anywhere from 100,000 bats to millions of bats are being killed each year by wind turbines. So we don't have really good data on that yet, but that's definitely a very big threat to bats. You know, for those folks that don't live necessarily next to forests, maybe we're in big towns like Milwaukee, we sometimes find that bats like our houses just as well as we do. And so if you don't contact someone who really knows what they're doing and cares about bats, actually evictions from houses can be a kind of a big threat to bats too, because sometimes we don't do that in the most appropriate way that we could. So then another thing would definitely be our population is growing. We're getting more and more people. We're moving more into those forested areas. We're you know, changing forested landscapes into more urban environments. That means that bats need more places for homes. So definitely some threats out there.
Well, let's go back to bat evictions from houses. Mm-hmm. And so what is the appropriate way? How would you like to see people who are dealing with maybe a bat infestation in their attic get rid of the bats?
Well, you know, everybody has a different level of comfort. So in my ideal world, if you had bats there and they were there in the summer, you'd let them stay for the summer because bats have their babies in May and June. When they first have their babies, they can't fly. It takes them about 3 to 4 weeks before they start to fly. So if you get those bats out and you close it up, you may be leaving baby bats behind, or you may be, you know, just getting them to a point where they're not going to be able to live. So you would wait until that summer period is over. Let them go to their hibernacula where they hibernate in the winter. Block any places that they can get back into, because if they can get in there, that's where they're going to want to go back. They're very faithful to the places that they live. And then you would just make sure that they're not coming back in. You're going to close all those holes up. A lot of times I think what happens is we actually go in there and we forcefully remove them. Maybe we don't clog that hole so they come back and you just continue to have that problem. So if you can wait until, you know, the bats are grown and can leave on their own, that's kind of the best thing to do.
What really gets you excited about working with bats?
Oh my gosh, everything. So I actually I started my career with the Forest Service on the Hoosier National Forest. And on that forest, we have a couple of federally endangered species, both the Indiana bat and the gray bat. And so those are the two species of bats that I got to start working with. And to me, everything about bats are fascinating, but especially the way that we get to study them. So bats are active at night, which most of us aren't necessarily active at night. They're really small. They're really fast. And they like to hang out in places that you don't normally go to. So some of our bats actually hang out in under the bark of trees or in cracks of trees, or they hang out in caves and things like that. So to me, it's always really fascinating to get to go visit those places where bats are active. But, you know, when we are trying to find out what bats are in an area, we get to do what's called mist net surveys. So we set up these – it's almost like a volleyball net, a little bit smaller holes than that. But you put them up in the middle of the woods, maybe in a roadbed or a place where you've got a little bit of an opening, and you set them up to see what bats are going to get caught in those nets. And they're such good echolocators. So in case folks don't know what that means, basically they send out sound. It bounces off an object. It comes back to them. And that's how they can navigate in the dark. A lot of people think that bats don't have good eyesight. They have eyesight about as good as we do, but they don't need it because they're active at night. So we put up these mist nets. They get caught in the net. We come and we check them. We take them out, and we actually get to handle these amazing little critters. We get to, you know, find out what kind of species it is, find out what the sex is, see if they're healthy. And every now and then you get one that's pregnant, and you get to do a little bit of pushing very gently along the spine, and you actually get to feel a little baby bat in there that hasn't been born. So to me, just being able to see them, to see if they're healthy and to learn more about the habitats they need is pretty amazing.
Why do you think bats have the reputation that they do? I mean, people might have sparrows in their attic and they aren't, for lack of a better term, creeped out the same way that they might be if they have bats.
You know, that's a really good question, and that's something that we've worked on for many, many years. And so I think there's a couple things. You know, one is just that whole thing of they're different. You know, they're active at night. That's a little bit spooky. They do fly around. You know, and so there are some wives' tales like bats get caught in your hair. I have actually talked to one person who said that happened, although I'm still kind of suspicious of that. You know, bats, they're very good echolocators. They can actually detect something the size of a human hair. So the likelihood that a bat's going to run into you or get in your hair is so small that I think we can probably say it's not going to happen.
They don't want to nest in your
hair. They don't want to be around you, just like you probably don't want to be around them. So I think that's part of it, is just that whole wives' tale of bats getting caught in your hair. I think most of the times when someone does encounter a bat close up and personal, it's a surprise. So maybe you've gone up in your attic and holy cow, there's a bat. Or you go into a cave and you disturb bats. And, you know, that's always going to catch you off guard. And then the other thing is, I think if you look at Hollywood and you look at how they often portray bats, they definitely get a bad rap in those cases. So I think if we set aside superstition, we set aside Hollywood notions, and we really learn about bats, I think anyone who's had an opportunity to either to study them or to watch, you know, maybe watch videos of them, I don't think those people are afraid of bats. I think they're probably pretty big fans of bats.
Well, I think we're becoming bigger fans of bats just from having you in the studio.
Yeah, that's great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cynthia Sandino is Regional Program Leader for Threatened, Endangered, and Sensitive Species within the Eastern Region of the Forest Service. It's based in Milwaukee. You'll find pictures of bats and more at WUWM.com. We'll be right back.